Welcome to the Litigation Finance Podcast. I'm your host, John Freund. This podcast is brought to you by the Litigation Finance Journal, the only dedicated news source to the litigation finance industry. Please visit www.litigationfinancejournal.com. Our guest today is Ben Fee, Managing Director of Fee Finney McDonald. Fee Finney is one of Australia's leading class action law firms, specializing in large-scale, complex litigation with a focus on shareholder class actions. To date, the firm has achieved over $500 million in settlements. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So we wanted to have you on because you recently gave some evidence to the Senate Economics Committee regarding the proposed changes to Australia's continuous disclosure laws. So let's just start with having you summarize your comments for us.
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, look, Fee Finney McDonald's position is that the proposed changes are both misconceived and dangerous. I mean, essentially what the government's trying to do, and they've said this expressly, is to make it more difficult to bring shareholder class actions in Australia. They're seeking to require plaintiffs to establish fraud, recklessness, or negligence to establish a continuous disclosure breach. And they also require the regulator, the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, to establish that fault element in order to pursue civil penalty claims. This is something that the regulator is definitely opposed to. And so, I mean, our position is that, look, this is going to weaken the regulatory framework that governs corporate disclosure in Australia. It sends the wrong message to company directors, and it introduces additional investment risk into the system.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I guess the crux of the argument really against large shareholder class actions, at least from what I've seen, it seems to be that, you know, these large payouts are associated with these claims. They're driving up the cost of D&O insurance, right? And this is being financially onerous to corporations, and it's deterring folks from accepting board positions. That's sort of the claim that the opposition to the litigation funding industry and large class actions is making. What would you say is the counter argument here? Because we are seeing D&O premiums rising in Australia. So if shareholder class actions are not the reason for that, then what would you say is the reason?
Yeah, look, I mean, insurers have for years been claiming that D&O premiums in Australia were rising due to shareholder class actions. But they've actually been doing so without ever providing any evidence of this. Now, I mean, the first cracks in this facade actually started to emerge in 2018. I mean, then there was an Australian Law Reform Commission process underway. And in that process, the global insurance firm Norton Rose Fulbright, they filed a submission in which they said that simply wasn't true. Norton Rose said that the reason for the significant premium increases in D&O is because insurers have been chronically mispricing premiums for a number of years and were seeking to regain ground. And look, that's since been confirmed to me in private conversations by a number of global insurance brokers that are involved in the sector. Now, I mean, one insurance broker that very publicly stands apart from the rest is Marsh in this debate. Now, I mean, Marsh has been a leading drumbeater for class action reform in Australia for a number of years. And in a parliamentary submission late last year, they came out and argued very strongly for class action reforms, saying in particular that by implementing changes such as these, insurance premiums would come down. I mean, this was picked up by the Commonwealth government championing these reforms. And in the explanatory memorandum to the current amending bill, the Commonwealth estimated that the reforms would produce a $900 million annual saving to industry. Now, I mean, it was only once the passage of the legislation seemed inevitable, once everybody thought that it would just go through, that the Insurance Council of Australia emerged to say in submissions in response to that explanatory memorandum that, look, while they supported the continuous disclosure reforms, obviously, that they no longer expected them to reduce D&O premiums in the short to medium term. And now, I mean, look, that seems, you know, highly suspicious to us. I mean, plaintiff lawyers are often, you know, a bit too quick to shout conspiracy. But, I mean, this now has every appearance of a lobbyist-fueled effort to boost insurance profits and appease company directors, and to do so at the expense of, I guess, the claimants who otherwise would benefit from those insurance policies for which the premiums are being charged. Now, I mean, it's an interesting debate here because, you know, these continuous disclosure changes were first introduced on a temporary basis under COVID-related emergency powers that basically allowed the Treasury to do whatever it felt like in order to protect the economy under the Corporations Act. I mean, we always, and you know, I guess all interested observers knew that the pandemic was really being used as cover, and everybody expected the government to make an attempt to have these changes made permanent. But I mean, it's telling to us that really nobody, aside from the vested interests that are involved, actually support these changes. I mean, there's widespread opposition from institutional investors. Retail investors are opposed. ASIC, the regulator, is opposed. I mean, even the Certified Practicing Accountants Association popped up, you know, to file a submission to say that they were opposed to these changes. Now, King and Wood Mallesons, you know, the global defendant law firm, they're not exactly the plaintiff's best friend. I mean, they conducted a survey of its clients during, I guess, the temporary regime when these sort of continuous disclosure reforms were in on a temporary basis. And 90% of the respondents basically said that they hadn't needed to rely on the changes, and 80% said that they shouldn't be made permanent. I mean, this clearly surprised Mallesons. They kind of had to insert this editorial note, this caveat on their own sort of survey results, saying that, look, you know, perhaps their clients just hadn't understood the question. But I mean, I think that really is sort of quite telling. You know, I think that even amongst the company director community, once you get below that sort of peak lobby group level, people understand that, you know, the changes that were being talked about, they don't only have implications for class actions. They actually have a much broader, you know, potential repercussions on company behavior and also on our financial markets. I mean, as it currently stands, the only organizations that do support these changes are key interest groups such as the Business Council of Australia, the Institute of Company Directors, and also the insurance companies that, of course, provide the Side C coverage for securities claims under their D&O policies.
Yeah, absolutely. That survey is very telling. And we are going to get to some of the potential consequences of this regulation in a moment. But I want to ask about this notion of social inflation. This is something that the insurance industry has been pushing lately. That is to say, basically, so what social inflation is you know, this idea that it basically you have a perfect storm of litigation funding, what they call aggressive tactics being used by plaintiffs' attorneys, and then a rising anti-corporate sentiment that is influencing jury awards and leading to, you know, very large claims payouts by insurers. What's your response to this argument that we're seeing it in America, we're seeing it globally now? What's your response to this?
I mean, that is an argument that, you know, may carry some weight in other jurisdictions, but it simply doesn't apply in Australia. I mean, at a threshold level, we don't have jury trials in Australian shareholder class actions. I mean, all of the class actions that have been before the courts have been in front of, you know, our judiciary, which is, you know, excellent and independent. Shareholder class actions rarely go to trial. I mean, the vast majority of cases settle here, and they do so for sizable amounts and, like, with really strong returns to group members, even after accounting for, I guess, the legal costs of solicitors and also the litigation funding costs. I mean, one of the key differences, obviously, in our jurisdiction is that we've got an adverse cost regime that it takes a lot of the excess out of the system and also most of the entrepreneurship. I mean, basically anybody that's involved in financing or conducting shareholder class action litigation, there's no interest in taking on speculative claims. I mean, the thresholds that get jumped through before a claim is actually commenced are very, very high. Now, that doesn't quite sit squarely with, you know, the defendant's arguments. I mean, clearly you've got powerful corporations that like to, you know, put forward this image that even when they're settling claims for vast sums of money, they're doing so despite the complete absence of legal liability. But I mean, it's a nonsensical argument, and we're surprised that it seems to have gained the traction that it has. I mean, a particularly telling moment was when last year, I mean, a corporate counsel for a class action defendant, you know, who had settled a claim for, I believe, north of 110 million Australian dollars, which in the Australian context, I mean, that's a large amount. I mean, they basically came out there and said that, you know, the reason for them entering into that settlement was not because they'd done anything wrong. In fact, they hadn't done anything wrong, but they just felt that they felt compelled to for commercial reasons in order to, you know, the sort of, you know, sotto voce kind of suggestion that they'd somehow been blackmailed or greenmailed into putting forward the sum of money. I mean, it's nonsensical. The idea that a company of that size would settle a case with that amount of money despite there being no wrongdoing, it just doesn't pass the pub test, as we say in Australia. and no one can sensibly believe it. And it's frankly just disappointing that, you know, the government, for a variety of reasons, seems to be going along with that. I mean, for context, I mean, we actually think that this entire issue has been blown completely out of proportion. You know, that really the idea that class actions and litigation funding should be on the regulatory agenda at all is purely a byproduct of the fact that you've got powerful insurers and powerful company directors that have taken such a keen interest and that appear to have gotten the government's ear, you know, during, I guess, the pandemic. I mean, in Australia, our class action regime has existed for 29 years now. And in that time, only 71 companies have faced shareholder class actions. Now, that's sort of less than 3 a year. I mean, class actions comprise 0.68% of all federal court filings. It's minuscule. I mean, and really, I mean, this should be a non-issue for anyone. The only reason it's come to the attention of government is because of, I guess, the profit motives of insurance companies and also the interests of a subset of company directors who, you know, understandably, they don't like their reputations being impacted by the allegations that they broke the law. But what the government's doing is then changing the law in order to avoid that reputational impact and passing the risk on to everybody else.
And that brings us to a potential consequence here of this regulation, which is increased corporate malfeasance, right? Because at the heart of all of these class actions is that issue, is corporate malfeasance. You know, essentially, if you're looking to regulate class actions, you want to make it harder to hold corporations accountable. So to me, and maybe this is the media guy in me talking, you know, I'm managing editor of Litigation Finance Journal. So for me, I hear that and I think, oh, that's an argument that the public can get behind. But I'm wondering from your perspective, is there a PR push on this being made from either from class action plaintiff law firms such as yourself or litigation funders? Or is this issue just like too esoteric for the general public and it's sort of being siloed within the court system and it's just not something that's worth pushing out on to make that sort of broad appeal that I just outlined?
I mean, look, there have been PR campaigns, at least in relation to, I guess, the previous round of class action reforms. And there's absolutely no doubt that, look, the Australian public is absolutely against corporate misconduct and malfeasance. There's a high degree of sensitivity to that. In particular, Australians have been conditioned by a series of royal commissions, like these judicial inquiries into the financial services and more recently the private aged care industries. And each of those inquiries has exposed absolutely disgraceful conduct on behalf of corporations. And that's been met with widespread outrage and followed by, you know, class action supported by litigation funders. And I mean, I actually think that, yeah, there absolutely is scope for this to become an issue in the next federal election. And that election is due to take place at some point in the next 12 months. I mean, whether or not the general public is going to get motivated in favor of, I guess, the industry, that remains to be seen. But certainly the general public should be highly motivated against misconduct and the government's attempts to cover that up.
Yeah, there's definitely, definitely an argument there to be made. You know, part of the reason I bring this up, so Litigation Finance Journal, we recently held a digital conference on Australia specifically. It was titled Australia, the Evolution of Litigation Finance Market. So it's good we're having you on now. The timing is perfect. Our panelists for that conference included Andrew Saker, the CEO of Omni Bridgeway, Stuart Price, CEO of, CASL, and Patrick Maloney, CEO of Litigation Capital Management. These are all Australia-based litigation funders. And one thing they all agreed on was that on this issue, the funding industry, they felt it was late to the game in really confronting this, sort of the attacks on the industry. And they felt like there was more they could have done earlier. I want to get your thoughts on that. You're an attorney and you're focusing on these large shareholder class actions. You often partner with litigation funders. If you could do it over again, what would you have done differently in terms of maybe being more proactive in addressing the criticisms, or would you have adopted some sense of self-regulation? Would that have helped at all? Or could you have focused on maybe educating regulators or more lobbying? I mean, what would you say to that?
I mean, look, it's really, and first of all, I mean, you know, the panel that you described is highly eminent, and I know all three of the members, and So certainly I'm not intending to cut across anything that they might have said. But I mean, from my own perspective, I mean, look, it's a complicated issue. I mean, there are a number of different factors at play. And like, I think the two big ones, look, I mean, there's cultural factors and also, I guess, practical factors. Now, I mean, culturally, I suppose, you know, the broader context for this argument is that, put simply, I mean, Australians have always liked to poke fun at plaintiff lawyers. I mean, Australians kind of poke fun at everybody. But I mean, you know, or despite the fact that plaintiff lawyers devote, you know, our working lives to helping people, you know, recover financially from tragedies, the fact remains that there are sort of, you know, less scrupulous sectors of the market, you know, particularly outside of class actions and into sort of other types of claims. And as a result of that, I mean, like, you can go to a barbecue and a stranger will have no hesitation in calling you an ambulance chaser. I mean, my uncle used to refer to me as practicing dog bite law. I mean, this is just kind of part and parcel of our life, and you develop a thick skin and you learn to live with it. I mean, some of it's in good humor, some of it's not. But I guess like what that dynamic has created is a bit of a cultural space. And within that space, the government has framed this reform agenda as basically being about it seeking to curb the excesses of greedy plaintiff lawyers and litigation funders, and to frame us as only looking out for ourselves. And, you know, that, you know, the reality is that that culturally creates a difficult space within which for us to fight. I mean, clearly I don't agree with that framing. You know, I do understand some of its genesis. And, you know, I think that, you know, it does mean that it's a difficult one to, it's a difficult, you know, area to engage in. I certainly think that there is scope for litigation funders to differentiate themselves from that dynamic. I mean, I've been a long-standing supporter of litigation funding, and we within our firm use litigation funding regularly. We think that it is incredibly valuable. It manages conflicts of interest. We think that a plaintiff lawyer doing their job well can, you know, help manage and curb some of the excesses that can otherwise kind of arise out of litigation funding. And equally, I mean, litigation funders doing their jobs well play an important role in sort of curbing some of the excesses that, you know, law firms might otherwise engage in, you know. And I think that, you know, that dynamic is something that a lot of our clients do appreciate and they sort of seek to support, to reinforce. But, I mean, I think, you know, looking beyond that, I mean, practically and in reality, I actually think that the class action industry in Australia has actually done a lot to answer the concerns that have been raised. I mean, I've been practicing in this area for a long time now, and I can say, you know, from experience that relative to 10 years ago, the litigation funders that we deal with now are a world away from how things used to operate, you know, a decade ago. I mean, funders have professionalized, they've improved their own disclosure practices, they've universally bolstered their capital bases, and I think that across the board, they're better managing their risk. And the growth of the industry has also importantly generated competition. And you know, that has, as in all markets, that competitive tension has actually improved both the quality of services, but also it's reduced prices. And, you know, so that, and that, you know, I mean, ultimately a lot of the government's criticisms do come down to price, you know, and in some cases they are completely off base, like they completely misunderstand the risks that are involved in, you know, funding litigation and, you know, are seeking to kind of play that up to their own advantage. In other cases, you know, and particularly historically, they did have a point. But in my view, ironically, it's actually the evolution of that industry in a free market that has already, particularly in shareholder class actions, removed a lot of the excessive costs and pricing that the government was actually complaining about. And you know, somewhat perversely, the government's current attacks and its reform agenda, if anything, is going to reduce the size of the market and start to unwind all of the cost reductions and that competition has actually produced, you know, to the benefit of the users of litigation funding and, you know, the participants of shareholder class actions. And so, look, we actually think that it's a bit of an own goal.
Yeah, you're sort of preaching to the choir here, but we've heard a lot about that on our side of the pond as well for quite a while. I want to get your predictions for my final question here. I want to get your predictions on how you think this will all play out. So, you know, you did mention that there's a lot of support here. I mean, law firms, the class action group members, litigation funders, obviously, ASIC, the regulator, even CPAs. Where do you think the government is ultimately going to come down on this? Do you think there will be enough of a pushback to stem some sort of onerous regulation, or How do you think this will play out?
I mean, particularly, and those who have followed the Australian market will know how dangerous it is to predict the future in terms of class action regulation in Australia. But I mean, one thing I can say for certain is that I really don't see the government's position changing. I mean, the government's really, put a stake in the ground, and we don't expect them to shift from that position, particularly in an election year, and particularly given the promises that have clearly been made to the insurance industry and areas of big business. There doesn't seem to be any kind of political advantage in them backing down. I mean, I think the key thing here is, we're also aware that within the government, there are a whole number of individual MPs and senators that are actually really opposed to these reforms, and also the broader sort of reform agenda. I mean, this has clearly been led by a couple, and I think that there is a broad recognition that, we've got a federal government that's on the conservative side of politics, but very much trying to appeal to the everyday person to say that they're there governing for the little people. I mean, I think that's another trend that we're seeing worldwide. And here, I think that there is an obvious tension where these kind of attacks do very much promote big, powerful corporate interests and tend to leave, the government's kind of ideal core constituency kind of exposed. I mean, the issue here in terms of this particular piece of the legislative agenda, though, is that it actually needs to get through the Senate. And the government does not of itself, so irrespective of its positions, it doesn't have the numbers to pass this legislation through the Senate, by itself. It needs the support of what we call the crossbench, which is a group of smaller parties and independents that are not actually part of the formal, opposition party. And now, I mean, look, Australia's crossbenchers are a diverse group. I mean, but what unifies them is a commitment to standing up for the less powerful, and they are strong opponents of corporate misconduct. Now, I mean, that's what I think creates the opportunity for a bit of rationality and a bit of common sense in this debate, for people to actually listen to ASIC, to listen to investors, to listen to the public. And if these crossbenchers stay true to their beliefs, then this proposal should go down in flames, and ASIC and investors and accountants, every Australian with a pension account should be able to breathe a sigh of relief, and hopefully Australia's world-class financial market can continue on in the same fashion that it has been.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, definitely, and certainly a timely issue. We definitely appreciate you coming on here and discussing it with us. We appreciate your LinkedIn post. That's what started this whole conversation. Ben, thank you so much for taking the time really to dig into this with us. We really appreciate it.
No problems at all. Thanks again.
Absolutely. And if you're interested in learning more about Ben and Fee Finney McDonald, you can visit them at their website, feefinneymcdonald.com. You can learn about their mission, some of the projects they have, their current projects, and some in the pipeline. So thank you very much. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next time on the Litigation Finance Podcast.